Hey there, listener. Just wanted to let you know the next Rotocross race is coming up. The next one is Levin, and that's this Friday, which will be the Friday the 3rd through to the 5th. That's going to be an awesome event, so you'll catch me at that. Hopefully you'll get along too. The next one after that is the Geraldine event, which is the Nationals, obviously down in Geraldine, which is the South Island. That's March 17th. There's going to be a lot of battling going on down there. They've got a hire pool picking people up from the airport, getting them to the field. There's plenty of places to stay down there, so get along to that if you can. That's going to be epic. This episode of the Hype Train podcast is brought to you by Quad Junkie. Quad Junkie has all the latest gear you could possibly need to get onto your race machine, with new stuff coming in every single day. Well, just about every single day. I've just ordered a bunch of ESCs, which are going to arrive tomorrow, hopefully. So if you, like me, need your hype gear immediately, get along to quadjunkie.co.nz and order your gear directly off the website using the coupon code THEHYPETRAIN, which will give you 5% off your entire order. This episode is also brought to you by raceflight.net. If you want to get your Race Flight Revolt board, ESCs, power distribution boards, motors even, or even a Shindrone's Orca, you can head over to raceflight.net. You can use the coupon code the Hype Train, and that'll give you 10% off your entire order. So we thank both Quad Junkie and Race Flight for their support. Now let's get on with the episode.
All aboard the hype train!
Choo-choo, motherfucker!
And we're live with episode 11 of the Hype Train podcast with me, your host, Magna Zan. Now today we're going to be talking legit bro laws, and what better person to have on the podcast with me to talk about legit stuff than Mr. Legit himself, Beardy Face Jacko. How you doing, Jacko?
I'm doing great, mate. I'm doing great. How are you going?
How's that echo working out for you?
It's beautiful, mate. It's echo-free.
Echo-free? Brilliant. Yeah. This is only the third time I'm starting this podcast.
But I want to be Batman sometime, mate. I'm sick of being Robin.
Well, I mean, what do you look like in a suit?
Pretty good, mate. You've seen me.
You've got a face for a mask, so.
Why do you think I do podcasts, mate? It's
just, yeah, it's face for podcasts, just like me. Brilliant.
Exactly.
All right. So we've got a special guest on today. He is the El Presidente of Model Flying New Zealand, the boss man himself, the head honcho, Jonathan Shorer. How are you doing, Jonathan?
I'm doing great. Good to hear from you.
Excellent. And you don't have echo at the moment? You're all good?
I have no echo.
Brilliant. Yeah, let's carry on then. So for those that don't know who you are, Jonathan, just give the listeners a quick rundown on who you are, how long you've been flying, you know, what you fly, all that kind of jazz.
I'm a recently retired guy, about 8 years. Came to New Zealand for the fabulous weather and the opportunities to fly whenever I wanted to. I've been flying since I was a schoolboy about 50 years ago, and I enjoy almost every form of air modeling, principally radio control, but if it's new and shiny, I want one, and I love to fly as often as I can.
So what do you normally fly on a kind of day to day then? Because presumably, you know, being retired, you're going to be wanting to fly almost every day.
I fly whenever I can. I was flying my quadcopter yesterday. I've been flying a 1950 vintage model today. So both ends of the spectrum.
Do they have quads back in 1950?
No, this is the very first radio-controlled aeroplane in New Zealand that had any success at all.
Wow.
A new copy of it, but a 1950 design.
Oh, and is that like a scratch-built kind of thing?
It's a 60-inch glider with a pusher propeller and designed for a diesel engine originally, but now with an electric motor in it.
Diesel? Jesus.
And I shall be fitting FPV gear in it as a bit of a sort of retro joke.
So you've seen a lot of change over this that, I mean, that time, you would have seen pretty much every evolution of technology through the hobby, from, you know, standard normal radios right through to computerized radios, analog to digital servos, gyros, all that kind of stuff. What do you think of those things has been the biggest change to the hobby over that time?
The design of this airplane I've been flying today is big and bulky because it was designed when the receiver was about the size of a Coke can, and it required a low-tension battery set, which was 3 volts, and a high-tension battery set, which was 100 volts, and had
100
glass,
volts.
Glass valves inside it.
Jeez.
And the absolute summit of control, if it worked at all, was either full left or full right, and nothing in between.
That's kind of like how Jacko flies a quad.
Yeah, that's how my throttle is.
Yeah, it's on a switch. Actual fact.
It should be a nice, stable FPV platform, and it'll be able to tootle around at...
How big is it?
It's a 60-inch wingspan.
60-inch. What's that in new money?
1.5 metres in new money.
Right, there we go. 1.5, that's not super huge. I was expecting it to be like a massive scale.
No,
but
it's not super huge, but I'm going to put the Eagle Tree Vector in it. And
yes. Yeah, we like those.
And the guys who really love the vintage equipment will go, "What have you done? Why hasn't it got a diesel engine in it?"
It's sacrilege.
can you get diesel engines still?
Yeah.
Jeez. Are they like super rare though? They must be super rare.
Amongst people of a certain age, they're very common.
Wow. Okay. Well, there you go. I didn't even know they had diesel engines in RC gear. I always thought it was nitro, you know, maybe the old two-stroke style. But, yeah, what do I know?
I've got a couple of diesel engines, I've got nitro engines, I've got petrol engines, and I've got a lot of electric motors. Generally...
You've got everything.
I try to keep the count at about 80 models, no more. More than 80 would be excessive.
Yeah, you can't hide them then.
They're tough. You've seen my garage. They're pretty tough.
Yeah, I've seen your garage, and I've seen the upper level to your garage as well.
And the upper level.
Yeah, that's what I had to do at my house. I had to put an upper level in just to sneak some extra gear in.
Those
planes take up a lot of room,
I find. I have 41 downstairs in the workshop and another 37 in the upper level. So many.
What's your total count, Jacko?
Ones I've killed or ones I've currently got?
Ones you've got currently in some sort of flying form-ish.
It's probably 20-ish, something like that.
20?
I've got a bunch of custom machines as well, but probably 20.
Okay, well, they don't really count, but... Nah. I think I'm running in double figures, but it's only just double figures.
But one of the big contrasts is in the 60s or so, 60s, 70s, you would probably have one set of radio gear, which you would unscrew from one aeroplane and screw into another aeroplane. Whereas now, with the price of gear, you can afford to have everything fully equipped, and you just chuck some batteries in and go flying.
So what was the average sort of equivalent cost of a machine back then? Like, if you had a plane back then and an equivalent now, what would be the sort of cost comparison between the two? If one of them cost like $300 now, what would it have cost back then?
I've been doing some research recently, and in the 1960s, a 4-channel radio gear would have cost you 2 months' wages.
Wow.
Or a house.
Nearly then, a house.
It would have been super cheap over here, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Hugely expensive compared to the average wage.
All right, so that's enough about that. Let's talk about... Let's do around the table, because you haven't been on for a while, Jacko.
Yeah, haven't. What happened, mate? Are we not talking?
Yeah, I think I've turned the sound down accidentally. There we go.
Are you back again, mate?
I'm back again.
User troubles there?
Mate, I think I muted my speaker. We're having lots of audio issues today. Did I cut you off at all then, Jonathan?
No, I'm fine. I'm good.
Okay. All right. Excellent. All right. Well, we'll go into round the table. And since you haven't been here for a while, Jacko, you can go first.
Why haven't I been here for a while, mate? Are we not speaking at the moment?
Because you're Batman.
Am I Batman this time?
Yeah, you can be Batman. I don't know. I don't know what you've been doing. Tell me why you haven't been around.
I've been working, mate. Been working. Working doing for my what? Money. I've been flying for people. I've been doing heaps of stuff. Heaps, mate. Heaps. I went to that UAV conference, the New Zealand one, run by UAV and Z, early last week, which is pretty interesting. Bunch of people with very fancy toys.
Anything interesting actually come out of it, though, other than it being interesting?
Well, no, it was just mostly interesting, really.
have you got a definition for interesting?
Interesting is actually quite hard to define, I find.
Right. Brilliant. So were people selling stuff, or what were they doing?
There was a lot of sales pitches going on, to be honest.
Right. Okay. So this is industry stuff, though, right? This is professional grade.
Yeah, yeah. Which you'll find most people in the industry who fly professionally also fly recreationally. There was an interesting presentation given by one of the Facebook engineers. I don't know if you've seen the Facebook wing called the Aquila. It's a massive wing that's designed to fly around at about 70.
Oh, the solar one.
Yeah, yeah. That streams into the third world. Yep. And he was on Skype and giving this presentation from somewhere in California, I think. And the internet connection was so bad we couldn't even understand his presentation. So it was slightly ironic that he's talking about a machine bringing internet to the third world and can't do it to New Zealand, the centre of Auckland CBD.
Well, I mean, we're kind of third world-ish. At least until April when I get fibre. So you've just been flying your big toys.
Yep, flying big toys for people all around the place.
Any lots interesting stories? Any better work stories?
Heaps of better work stories, mate. Heaps of better work stories. It's all top secret, though. Could tell you, have to kill you. That sort of deal.
Alright, Jonathan, do you want to go next? Is there anything you have been working on this week or... since the last... Well, you don't listen to our podcast, do you? Shame on you.
No, this is my first. Well, quite a lot of this week, I've been following up on stuff that Jacko learned at the UAS conference. One of the hot topics which resonates around the world is the question of registration for RPAS or drone operators or whatever you call it. A lot of people have been watching the developments in the United States with the FAA bringing in compulsory registration. And there are a couple of bodies in New Zealand who think that's a good idea as well.
Why is that? Why do they think it's a good idea?
Because they're misinformed.
because they believe that bad guys will put their registration number on an aircraft so they can be tracked after it crashes. Seems a touch naive to me.
Yeah. I think it has a lot to do with you can charge a fee if you register it. So for the likes of some websites which we won't name, where you register your flight to fly, you'll be charged to do so, and so you'll have to have a registration number to do that. I don't think it offers anything safety-wise, personally.
Well, it's not a safety thing, is it? It's not going to stop you crashing.
No.
Who cares?
Well, it's more to be able to track down people who are doing illegal stuff.
So you get your binoculars out and you look at the drone flying up and you go, oh, I can see that number. That's a 135. So let me just check on the database and see who that. That's not going to happen, is it?
Well, my plan is if I'm gonna fly drugs into a prison. And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to register my drone.
Yeah, exactly. It's and if somebody does crash it, a few people I know that have got, you know, a fair bit of expense set into a drone or, you know, whether it be a plane or a quad of some sort, they have their phone number on it anyway. So registration is completely irrelevant.
One of the things I've done this week is I've been talking to a guy with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the USA organization for model aeroplane guys, and said, well, how successful is the US scheme? And he said, well, they have 700,000 people registered now as ARPAS pilots, and there have been one or two instances of aircraft that have gone down, and somebody's gone, oh, look, there's a registration number inside of here, and they've tracked the owner back. The one illegal activity which they've cited is some guy who was using his Phantom to look through bedroom windows, and they found him, not because of a registration number, but because he also filmed his own face. So his image was on the SD card, and the police knew him because he had a record as a voyeur. So the registration scheme, totally irrelevant in that case. He was just dumb and took his own picture and then left it on the SD card.
I mean, stupidity is generally self-policing, though, I find.
I feel like there's a pro tip involved in that.
Yeah, there's definitely a pro tip involved in that in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, this week we had somebody put on Facebook a picture of a gun outside a car saying, I'm going to shoot down the next drone I see. He, in the background is a picture of his house and the name of the street he lives on.
Awesome, isn't it?
Yeah.
These people are clever.
There's some very stupid people out there, and unfortunately, or fortunately, it's now very easy to get into the sport or the hobby for very little money and do stupid stuff. So I don't see that getting any better anytime soon, and I certainly don't think registration's the way to go. If anything, it's more preventing the purchase in the first place. But, you know, it's just, yeah, you take cars as an example, you can still get stupid people that have a license.
Mm.
You know, you're not going to stop stupidity or criminal activity with a registration. It just seems a bit pointless. But that's my take on it.
But, you know, you should have instructions in the box that say you are now a pilot and flying stuff requires you to comply with local law. And taking a picture of the Airbus as it comes into land is not a good idea.
But, you know, for a normal person, you'd think that they would register that isn't an okay thing to do.
Yeah.
And that goes back to that stupidity thing again, where, you know, stupid people are stupid.
There's a quote right there,
stupid
mate.
Stuff.
Can I get that on a shirt?
Yep. No problem.
Yeah.
We'll sort that out for you.
Yeah, a picture of your face and stupid people are stupid. That'd work.
And another story that's popped up during the week is the Christchurch fires, and a story that the helicopters doing the fire suppression work had been hindered by drones in the air.
Mm.
It's not clear whose they were. Did they belong to the media? Did they belong to the fire service, who are actually using drones for thermal imaging, or were they people who thought they'd get some neat video? And it's important that people who want to take some neat video are aware that there are times when there are exclusion zones, and it's a bad idea to put your DJI in the sky when the helicopter guys are trying to go around saving lives.
Other than being, you know, sensible and going, okay, there's a fire on that hill, there's choppers going in and out, I should probably not fly my Phantom over there. Apart from those, and, you know, sticking my Phantom in front of an Airbus, that kind of thing. The other side of that is that in places where there isn't that kind of activity going on, where you might want to get a good shot, there probably is, but I don't know where the information is readily available to say instantly, yes, I can fly here. Is there something like that? Is there an app on my phone I can use? Is there, you know, even a website I can go to and just, you know, use my GPS location and say, yes, you're okay to fly?
DJI's Go app does that to some degree. It won't let you fly within a registered aerodrome within 4Ks of it. Pardon me. But that is also a pain in the ass, because if you are legit and you have your wings or you've got a UAV cert, it won't let you fly, then you've got to call up China and jump through hoops to get it to be unlocked. There's a bunch of apps out there. None of them are totally foolproof. You've kind of got to take it on your own head and say, look, I'm going to work out exactly if I can fly here or not.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the biggest thing is to look for air traffic, right? And I know there's a bunch of air traffic apps you can get on your phone. I've used that previously, just to make sure that there's nothing in the area.
They only work with aircraft with ADS-B and transponders currently. So pretty much all light aircraft don't have them because it's not mandatory at the moment for them to. So you only get the big aircraft pop up on those sort of apps.
Bugger. So, okay, there's not really a one place to go then.
Not yet is the answer. There is a good app that the Brits have developed, which shows you whether it's safe to fly in that area. But it's a question of scale. Is it? When will it become something that the New Zealand authorities will do to put an app on their phone? The Brits have a very good app that shows you where all the NOTAMs are, so you can see whether any specified low flying going on. But we don't have that kind of technology instantly available. Right now, what you really need to do is to look at the paper maps, which show you which is controlled airspace, where you need to ask the tower for permission before you can fly there, and which is what they call Class G airspace, which is when you can fly anytime you like, with up to 400 feet and away from 4 kilometers from airfields. But there is still the bugbear of the permission to overfly rule, and that's something which I spend a lot of time working on.
There's a lot going on, and I guess it's only going to get more challenging as more things get in the air for both the authorities and for the pilot alike. It would be good to have somewhere to go to actually find out, yes, I can fly, no, I can't fly. Aside from, the stupid people.
I mean, it may be that as the DHL and UPS and Domino's Pizza people get more further down the road with commercial use of drones, it becomes more routine and accepted. What we need to be aware of is that one or two companies believe that they have the technology to totally manage the sub 500 foot airspace and make it their own. Large global companies who have a lot of throw and could easily push the hobby off the face of the planet.
Oh.
We don't like those guys.
No, we don't like those guys. Who are those guys? Get Bruce Simpson onto those guys.
But everybody wants to buy their stuff.
Yeah.
That's the big conundrum.
It's going to be an interesting few years, I think. I think in the next sort of 10 years, a lot of this stuff is going to come to head, I guess. But anyway, for now, we can still race, particularly with drones and FPV, which is always good. So another reason for getting you on today was to talk about the Levin event for Rotocross. And for those that don't know, well, firstly, where Levin is, it's in the bottom of the North Island in New Zealand, because we get international listeners, Jonathan, just so you know. There's like two people.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe three. I don't know. Shout out to those people.
Do they even speak English, or they just downloaded the wrong thing?
No. One of them is English, definitely not his first language, because he's not in an English-speaking country. So that's one. But we get a few people from the US as well, and some other places like the UK. That's third world, isn't it?
That's pretty much the whole world, yeah.
Yep. Sweet. There we go. So the Levin event. When was the first Levin event? Was it 2 years ago?
It's more than 3 years ago now. It was beginning of November 3 years ago. And we had a very simple course and nobody could get round it. and now we have a really complex course and people rip round it in under a minute. So
yeah.
It has been an immense transformation. in what people are capable of doing and what the equipment's capable of doing.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And just so people understand that when we talk about the live-in event, this is actually at your house and at your property, right?
Yep, it's in my garden. I do have quite a big garden. I have about 5 acres. We bought the property because it has a big paddock that I could fly fixed-wing aeroplanes from. And subsequently, I had a lake dug, which has been a bit of an obstacle for quad flyers, but is great for float planes. And I have a small wood, which again has become a terrific obstacle for the drone flyers as we rip around in amongst the trees. But I've spent the last couple of weeks, I'm developing 4 courses, a night course, an advanced course, a wing course, and a beginner's course. So there's quite a bit of work goes into that. I've cut down a couple of trees because they were in the way of where I wanted the drones to go.
That's dedication, that.
And I was trying to explain. I was trying to explain this to when we were in Hawaii to some of the US guys that that we actually race mini quads FPV around the modified New Zealand president's backyard. So that's like the AMA, right? And they couldn't get over that. Like, if they went round to the AMA, the head of the AMA's house, and raced FPV around his house, how that would work?
He'd probably actually be super happy.
They didn't get that impression of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, they are a different organisation on an enormous scale. They have, I think, about 70 full-time employees. They have just short of 200,000 members. It's awe-inspiring, the difference in scale.
Yeah.
But they have pushed hard to make FPV and drone flying a part of the hobby. We all work in different ways, but we're all going in the same direction.
Yep, it's awesome.
No, it's I'm always blown away when we go there. It's the track that you put up every single time is always an advancement on the previous time that we've been there. And it, you know, the fact that you allow us to arrive and fly for 3 days is immense. And
take over your house.
Yeah,
take over your house as well.
6 people booked in to stay in the house with us, and another 6 staying in the house next door, which we rent. We had 8 people camping on the lawn last time, so it's a big influx of people, and we feed them 3 times a day, and it's great fun.
And that's the thing as well, is that it's not just a day event. It's not just an event where you just turn up. It's more like a mini festival, would be the best way to describe it. You've got stuff going on through the day with it, you know, the proper racing and whatnot. Then you've got the evening, everyone's chilled out a little bit more, then the night comes, and then it's, you know, we're getting tiny whoops out, and we're getting night stuff out, night wings out, night courses out, and it just goes on and on and on, and it's just an awesome 3-day event.
I'm looking for another repeat of the FPV combat with streamer towing.
Yeah, that was so awesome.
At the end, when we finish the racing for the day, we'll put some quads up with streamers on the back, and make some terrific film.
Well, didn't you still have that tape on your machine like a year and a half later, Jacko?
Yeah, it was still wrapped around the motor. I left it there as a souvenir.
I'll post these videos up because I think there's videos of these on my YouTube. So I'll put links in these to the show notes.
The development for next week's course is that as you come out of the wood, instead of coming out round the corner, you have to punch up out through the centre of the wood and over the tops of the trees and then dive back down onto the course. And we had a trial with Paul Clegg this week, and he managed to, after he put it in the tree the first time, the next 3 times he did it successfully, and it makes really sick video.
Now I'm looking forward to it. And you've got this mad gate, this double gate tower as well that you've built, right?
Yeah, we have the giant rugby post double gate, which is a You go through high, do a vertical 180, then a horizontal 180, and it's right in front of the start-finish line, so it'll be maximum spectator fun.
Yeah, awesome. And have you changed the tree track much from last time? Have you altered the path through there, or
is it... No, other than the punch out at the end. The route through cool. the trees is the same.
All right.
The safety gates are there so that people can stand behind a fence and watch the quads rip past them a meter away.
Yeah, it's cool.
And we'll have the live TV feed as usual.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then
that's
add to the prop tree.
Yeah, add to the prop tree. Are all the props still in there, or have you taken them out?
No, the props are still jammed in the tree. A few of them have fallen out and they got chomped up by the mower, but it makes me laugh when I'm mowing the field to find bits of prop. Months later, I'm still finding bits of prop. Archaeologists in a million a year's time will go, what are all these little bits of plastic stuck in the grass?
Yeah.
I suspect they don't decompose very quickly either.
No.
The old props. So how many pilots are we expecting at this event?
I think we've got about 13 or 14 registered in 4S and about the same in 3S. There's some duplication, but I'm expecting between 15 and 20 pilots. Got guys who are booked in for somewhere to sleep who've not yet got unregistered on Multi-GP.
Yeah, I suspect it's probably going to be more like in the 20s, I would have thought, and then... You know, you've got all the extra people as well, so it's probably going to be, what, 30 plus people there, realistically?
Yeah, and we'll get a lot of spectators from all of the local clubs down the bottom end of the North Island. They'll come to watch.
Cool. It's going to be awesome fun. I'm super looking forward to it.
I'm super gutted I can't go.
I know, what's that about? What can't
you go? It's a sad face, mate. I've got working, and then I've got to go to Stag Do, and... I tried to get him to remove a stag do, and he just won't do it for me. He said, look, mate, it's Levin. Wouldn't do it.
It's not worth going to a stag do, to be honest, is it? Yeah. Does he not know the importance of Levin?
That's pretty much what I said, mate. Like, you're dead to me.
I'd just be raging hard. You're going to miss out on the wings. I want to see you hit some poles.
I know, and I need to catch up as well, mate. I'm falling down the points.
True.
Terrible state of affairs.
So the events that are going to be at Levin we're obviously doing drone racing, 3 and 4S. We'll be doing wings, presumably. Is that a rotocross event as well? Or is it just a fun wings race?
I think it's a fun race.
Okay.
And we've also got three people registered for sportsman, clubman, the entry level. So we won't make them fly around tree course. We'll just make them go through the gates out on the field.
Oh, it's always fun sending him into the trees, though.
Well, it didn't last very long, though.
This is true. This is very true. No, that's cool. All right, so... And previous events that we've had at Levin have been... Well, we've obviously had the rotocross events, but we've also did the Worlds qualifiers for Drone Worlds in Hawaii, both for wings and for quads. I see that there's did you see that there's a Seoul event? A World Championships there in Seoul? South Korea. I don't know whether you've seen that yet.
How many worlds do we have, mate? Because there seems to be a hell of a lot more world championships than there are worlds.
Well, you've got to have multiple world championships, mate, for multiple worlds.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. Is it like a multiverse sort of situation?
Yeah, I think so. Well, if you ever follow the Flash, there's more than one Earth.
Oh.
In the multiverse.
That's what's going on. Maybe that's what's going
on. Yeah. So you could be like the world champion of Earth 1, and then the world champion of Earth 2. So
but the next best one is 700 million light years away.
Mm.
Yeah, or was it? No, there was a closer one there, didn't they?
Big
just
excitement yesterday. It was, yeah. It was like 700 light years to get there.
Your travel time's going to be a bitch.
Send the robots out there.
You get lots of air miles, though.
Now, all right. So, I've completely lost where I was. My train of thought now.
Seoul. Seoul? Seoul.
Seoul. Say that, that's right.
Korea.
Seoul.
I can say Korea.
It's Seoul. It's just Seoul.
Seoul.
Have you seen that? Have you seen that, Jonathan? The fact that there's this world championship in Seoul?
I haven't picked up on that. I've been following the FAI and their dealings with the European Rotocross Sport Racing Association. FAI are quickly getting on the FPV racing scene, and it will be, I'm sure, an FAI recognised World Championship sport this year or next year.
So that's like the legit one, which I suppose that's is like a good segue world. into the next section. Let's shuffle into the next section, which is what I wanted to discuss with you also, and that's the Model Flying New Zealand side of what you do, because obviously you're the president of Model Flying New Zealand, so you not only deal with the rotocross events and putting on awesome events for rotocross, which is separate of Model Flying New Zealand, your Model Flying New Zealand duties and what Model Flying New Zealand did. Do you want to just give the people a quick spiel on what it actually is and what you do on I guess a day to day, and what you've been doing most recently?
Model Flying New Zealand is an association of about 2,200 model aeroplane enthusiasts, based in 76 clubs around the country, and our role is to provide them with an infrastructure which gives them insurance for their activities. We help look after flying sites for clubs and talking to local authorities and landowners about that. We provide a magazine which we put out five times a year with general news in. And our main function is to liaise with the authorities, principally the Civil Aviation Authority, to make sure that what rules there are around model aeroplanes are suitable for the hobby and not overly restrictive. And it's a time of great change at the moment because of the new technologies are making model aeroplanes and drones ever more accessible and more widespread. And it's difficult to know how widespread the hobby is. Generally, we think probably about a quarter of people who fly stuff are actually members of MFNZ. So there are probably about 10,000 people in the country, most of whom fly from their backyards or parks or whatever. And it's really only the people who fly big planes that need real estate that want to belong to a club. One of the most significant aspects of the latest round of rule changes is that normal people who fly from their paddock, they can only fly over their own paddock or surrounding land that they've got permission to fly over. If you're a member of Model Flying New Zealand, you can fly from any of our club sites without having to go and ask people's permission. And we have up and down the country about 275 club sites where those permission requirements are not needed. And additionally, normally you're only allowed to fly up to 400 feet, but we have 27 sites where you can fly at varying heights, but up to around 1200 to 1500 feet above ground level. So if you're flying a big plane, a big aerobatic plane or a jet, you need the higher height clearance, and that's what our clubs can give you.
Right, so you're catering for pretty much everybody that's flying something in the air, pretty much.
The span is enormous. One of the planes that I've just built recently is designed for indoor flying, flying in large sports halls. It's powered by a length of elastic band, a rubber motor. It weighs 11 grams, and I'm told mine's far too heavy. I should have built it down to about 8 grams, which is super, super light and flies at about walking pace. At the other end of the spectrum, I'm dealing at the moment with a replica of the V1 flying bomb, which has been built for the Omaka Air Show, and that weighs 78 kilograms and is powered by 5 electric ducted fans. So everything in between 8 grams and 100 kilograms, rubber powered, electric powered, jet powered, any kind of fuel burning engine, are all within the scope of the hobby.
Cool. And for those that are obviously haven't watched a Bruce Simpson video in the past 2 years, wouldn't know what Model Flying New Zealand is or the CAA. So for those that have probably would know, as a comparable organisation, would be the AMA out of the US and the FAA out of the US. And our equivalents over here are the Model Flying New Zealand and CAA, for those that are not putting those two and two together. So I know, I still see a lot of comments around on various pages and Facebook pages, mainly around New Zealand and whatnot. Specifically around the drone flyers and quad races, and I suppose it would also cover people that are flying Phantoms, who some will point out, what does Model Flying New Zealand do for me? Because you've just gone and told us that, you know, you help out with clubs and you help out with fields and you help out with all this kind of stuff. But I guess what people don't understand is that Model Flying New Zealand, and specifically you two in particular, have been dealing with the CAA and the councils. So a lot of the regulations that we've got over here are due in part, and the freedom we've got now to fly in parks and whatnot in some places, primarily down to you guys. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, we have 5 area representatives, they're called, throughout the country, and Jacko is one of them, up in the top end of the North Island. And they generally deal with local councils who have been needing to introduce bylaws to control the use of the new technology in parks. What we're able to do is, when we hear of a council who are looking at new bylaws, we're able to say, well, another place, they've already come across this problem and they've come up with a pretty decent set of rules. And on several occasions, we've sent another council's rules and they go, ah, well, this saves us writing it from scratch. We are happy to adopt and adapt another council's rules and use them. And by doing that, we are gradually rolling out some pretty sensible regulations across the country. We've gone from councils saying, well, the easy answer is to ban everything, to, well, we actually see how we can permit you to fly almost anywhere apart from one or two sensitive places. And we've had a councillor who said, yes, you can fly in any park you like, but not in the cemetery. We'd rather you didn't fly your drone around the cemetery, which seems to be quite reasonable.
Yeah, and that's cool. And particularly in Auckland, at least, because, you know, I've spoken to a few international people, and when we were in Hawaii, I got talking to BMS Webb, so Paul, whatever his second name is, BMS Webb. And one of the things he asked me was, what's the situation like flying in New Zealand? And I was like, well, what do you mean? He goes, you know, do you have any problems flying there? And I was like, no, we just fly anywhere we like. We fly in any parks we like, as long as we're below the height of the nearest tallest building within 100 metres, or tallest structure within 100 metres. He was like, oh, he was actually quite surprised. And when I probed a little bit further, it was because he had been, you know, watching YouTube videos from Jacko's mate, and he had this skewed view of what the flying situation was in New Zealand, and it was, I was like, no, the, you know, Model Flying New Zealand had sorted the majority of places out, at least the big cities out. There's not really an issue flying anywhere as long as you're not a dick. And he was like, okay, that's not what I understood. I was like, well, there you go. So I think that's a lot of the case for a lot of people, particularly overseas. Not so much for New Zealand now. A lot of people that want to get into drone racing and whatnot generally know the rules, you know, keep it below the tree height. And for the most part, we are below the tree height anyway, because that's where it's most exciting to fly. So, how much work? I mean, how long did it actually take you guys to actually get these things through to the major councils, at least? Was it quite an easy, quick process or not?
It's an Auckland ongoing process.
Auckland Council, I can speak from. It took roughly 6 months of going backwards and forwards and meetings with council. They initially wanted 400 grams as the maximum weight that could be flown in a park, and we got up to 1.5 kilos to allow for the Phantoms to be flown, because a Phantom with a battery on it is 1.5 kilos. And that was how we got to that point. It'd be awesome if we get slightly more than that, but I think 1.5 is about right for what you'd be flying in a park.
Yeah, because anything over that is going to be relatively large.
Yeah, so, yeah, and it's like you got in spires and stuff like that, just speaking from the droners. And if you're flying an spire, you're probably flying it professionally anyway, so you're not really using it for recreational purposes.
No. So, yeah. Mm.
I think that's probably for the average council, thinking about Christchurch and Upper Hutt and place, probably 6 months from realizing there's an issue to getting some decent rules in place. It's about 6 months is a good one. As far as the CAA is concerned, we've been working hard on it for 3 years now, and we're looking now to start phase two of the rule change, which is another 5-year program. So it's a constant job to manage the regulatory side of it so that the hobby's not overly impacted.
Right, and is that due to the fact that the technology changes and more people are getting into it, or is it due to kind of rule revisions based on incidents or whatever it might be, you know, loopholes and that kind of stuff? What's driving the changes is my question, I guess.
The changes are driven by the need to accommodate more and more commercial use of unmanned aircraft within the airspace and integrate them with the overall airspace. You've got to remember that at the top end of the scale, the big parcel carriers are looking to introduce unmanned twin engine jets. So whilst 250 drones are great fun for racing, the top end of the spectrum is certainly unmanned cargo planes, and how you integrate freighters into passenger carrying aircraft is a major headache it's a big job to get right. But all of this takes place within the context of all the other aviation legislation that needs to go on. And Jacko mentioned earlier on ADS-B, the biggest program on the books at the moment is New Southern Skies, which is replacement essentially of air traffic control by radar to air traffic control by satellite-based systems. And it is a monstrous infrastructure project, huge connotations on all of manned aviation. So guys with toy aeroplanes flying in their backyards have to take their place in this whole process.
Right. So the Modelfly New Zealand isn't necessarily there governing rules around, you know, what the cargo freight planes are going to be doing. It's more around protecting the modelers themselves to make sure that we're still going to be able to fly in the same airspace, essentially.
We're guarding against the unintended consequences big commercial interests getting rules set up to suit them and finding that we've been squeezed out of the margins.
Right. And is that happening across the globe, presumably?
Yes. And right. One of the developments we're watching very closely is Europe, where the European Aviation Safety Agency are in the middle of producing new regulations for the whole of Europe, the first draft of which banned all model aircraft flying.
Jeez.
and there is now a community-based organization of about 8 countries representing 500,000 model aeroplane enthusiasts saying, excuse me, what have we done to have our hobby eliminated?
Yeah, it seems... is that just the ignorance on the rule makers, or is it, you know, it's probably not a deliberate attempt to do that, is it? I would have thought.
No, it's a if we don't know how to regulate it, if we eliminate it, it won't be a problem.
That'll fix it.
Yep, just get rid of it. Get it.
If I can recollect the numbers correctly, their first draft was that no model aeroplane should be more than 250 grams and shouldn't fly further than 100 meters away from the operator. Period.
What? Jeez.
But, I mean, there's been immense pushback against that by the FAI and the national bodies, and it will be redrafted. But it's when you first read these things that you go, what?
Yeah.
Who wrote this?
Yeah. Well, I guess there's some of it is pushing the look as well, or maybe just not knowing what models are there. You know, because if they're not deeply ingrained in the hobby side of it, but are only in the commercial side, then I guess that stuff kind of makes sense at the time of writing for them. But yeah, it's good that there are that Model Flying New Zealand and whoever else are getting involved with these things to make sure that we're not going to get slapped aside and we can continue doing our sport.
And New Southern Skies could actually be a positive thing for model flying. Part of the thing with the new technology is they can stack these planes closer together and on top of each other, well, within a tighter vertical separation, which actually means like the control space around Auckland will shrink, allowing there to be more Class G airspace. It's just making sure that happens and it doesn't go crazy and go the other way.
Yeah, but the first inklings of it are that the programmed approaches take up more airspace, and all of the non-ADS-B users are still using their current airspace, so it's actually encroaching rather than reducing airspace at the moment. And there is a promise that ADS-B will free up airspace, but that's yet to be proven. And 2 years ago now, I had a guy from Airways saying, well, all your model aeroplanes should be fitted with ADS-B transponders.
Because that's practical. I mean, how big are those units? Are they quite big units, I imagine?
They're about the size of a car radio and, and are about as voltage hungry. So yeah, the
current ones are 16 watts to be legal and certified. It's a 16-watt transmitter. And you can imagine what having 16 watts blasting out of a mini quad would do. It would just destroy everything.
Yes.
You wouldn't be able to fly the thing.
Jeez.
There is new technology coming out which has shrunk them a lot. Like, these things are roughly the size of a micro SD card. And but they're running I think it was 10 milliwatt. But none of this has actually been certified yet. It's just the technology does exist. It's waiting for a body like FAA to pick it up and certify it. And if FAA do that, and the CAA will do that, and IATA will pick it up, and then everyone will do it. It's just waiting for that process to happen.
And
aviation, well, I guess it could be integrated. It could be integrated into the flight controller or receiver or something, though. Yeah. Presumably, if it got to that point.
Possibly, but in one of the examples that we cited in saying, "Is this really a good idea?" was the Model Aeroplane Club in Dunedin, who fly within the control zone, within 4 km of the airport. So the guy is sitting in the control tower, and he's got 40 echoes coming off the ADS-B transponders in all the model aeroplanes sitting in the club. Have we made
his
job any easier?
Yeah, I suppose it's a valid point. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't want the job of writing these rules. I don't think there's going to be any one rule that's going to please everybody.
No, it's definitely not easy.
No. And that's probably
aviation
why it's going to take a five years for the CAA one to go through.
Yeah. Even 5 years in terms of aviation law is moving really quickly. Aviation's got a history of moving slowly. That's why most piston aircraft you see around were built in the 50s and still run 1950 technology. It's because it's proven, it works, and it's been safe since then, and they don't want to change that. So change happens really, really slowly in aviation.
All right. So Model Fly New Zealand has been helping out with the rules and whatnot for drone flyers, and that's how it directly affects pretty much anybody wanting to fly something in the air, right?
Recreationally, at least.
Recreationally, yes, yeah. Yes, and that's kind of where I was going at, because I see, you know, stuff on the Rotocross page, you know, Model Fly New Zealand, what do I need them? What do they do? Blah blah blah. So that hopefully will dispel that myth that they don't do anything for the hobbyist. The other thing that you guys do is you have legitimate New Zealand teams that you send to World Championship events. Now, you mentioned it earlier on that you're talking with, I always get this the wrong way around, FIA?
Nope, wrong.
Other one, FAI.
FAI.
FAI, I always get those two mixed up.
The Federation Aeronautic International?
The other one is International Autosport.
That's it. That's why I always get them mixed up, you see. So you've been dealing with for those guys to do what exactly? You just want to run through what the plan there is.
Well, at the upper level, individual countries are licensed by the FAI to create national teams to compete in world championships. And at the moment, we are the world champions for discus launch glider. I went with a team almost 2 years ago now, and one of our guys, Alex Hewson, who is a drone racer and fantastic pilot of almost everything, is the world champion, and has a effectively an Olympic gold medal for aerosport. And he formed part of the team with Joe Wirtz and Kevin Botherway, who also won the team championship. So the FAI control all world championships, and they are also the main body who negotiate with all of the national authorities and ICAO, the International Civil Air Authority, Aircraft Organization. And so they represent the hobby to the global authorities. FAI also look after all manned sport as well, gliding championships, parachuting championships. It was they who staged the World Air Games this year, we sent a couple of guys along. And, you know, whilst there are World Series, if you want to be world champion, it needs to be the FAI world champion. And we send several teams overseas each year to compete in world championships. And I'm off to the Ukraine in July with the Soaring team to defend our F3K World Championship.
So they're planning to do a drone racing World Championship. I did see that they put on some events over the last year. I think there was six or so events. I don't know whether that was just a trial, or whether there was a legitimate world championship team that came out of that, or person.
There isn't an FAI World Championships yet. The class is called F3U, and there will probably be a World Championships this year or next year. Because the sport's developing so fast that it's actually hard to know what a championship course would be, or, our rules change almost every race as we develop them. And the sport is not yet really settled enough to have every nation competing on the same playing field.
It's interesting you bring that up, because I was listening to the Quad Talk podcast with Trappy from Team Black Sheep, and one of the comments he made was that he believes that events really need to be a seasoned event, where the gear that you buy is specified for that season, Much like car racing, you know, radio controlled car racing. Apparently, they have the tires selected. That, you know, you can only buy certain types of battery and all that kind of stuff. So that it's mandated and it's restricted. So that it makes it more competitive. I think if FII went down that route for a season for the that World Championship season, I think that would be certainly a good start in getting it standardized. I don't think you're going to get a standard track layout because I think they change so quickly and the pilot skill has changed so quickly. But the other thing as well is it sounds almost as if the FAI is akin to what CAA is with aviation. It's a more slower moving organization and a body to get these things going. Whereas you look at things like MultiGP or IDRA or the DRL or, you know, all these kinds of things where they're just out there trying it. And coming from I work with computers and information technology, and one of the things that they talk about in that is, you know, fail first, fail fast. So the idea is that you try new stuff immediately, and if it fails, you revise it and then you fix it and you carry on and essentially you get it to market quicker, and that's the whole idea behind that. I think that approach is probably not going to work for FAI, but they need to, suspect, quicken up their time to market almost to get these events out. Because I was privy to a lot of the emails last year, and there was a lot of backwards and forwards about real stupid stuff like a fail-safe switch. And then we talk about it for like 2 weeks about how a fail-safe switch needed to be on and whether it needed to be mandated on a switch on the radio, and it had to be a specific switch, and, you know, GPS, and whether that should be mandated, and whether the fail-safe should kick in, and whether it should drop like a rock, or whether it should land, you know, all this kind of largely nonsense. As opposed to just getting on with it and just going, okay, well, let's run some events, let's see what actually works, let's see what everyone else is doing, and let's see what we can improve on and make standard, and then go from there.
I agree. Otherwise, they risk losing a grip on the hype, and you'll have other organisations pop up, and then the FAI will kind of become irrelevant to everyone else in racing mini quads. Even though they'll have the legit world champion, they'll won't be relevant.
I think the difficulty with a specified set of gear is that it clearly favours one manufacturer, and there's a whole pile of difficulties with saying, well, this year we'll only use immersion gear or we'll only use TBS gear, and how they choose the favoured manufacturer. And what that does for the rest of the industry is a very difficult one to get right.
Yeah, and look, even just picking, you know, a motor type, 2206, 2300 kV, you know, 50-40 props, for example, even that doesn't work because you can fiddle with those numbers, and as motors come out with different magnets and stuff, they're essentially akin to a larger motor and more speed, more power, all that kind of jazz.
You can the FAI currently do through electric stuff is you run a watt minute limiter, so you've got a max amount of energy you can use, and you can use that energy really quickly, or you can use it over a period of time. It sits in there. It's a tiny little device, and it'll shut your throttle off once you get to that point. So it's all about conserving the amount of energy you've got, and it totally levels the playing field. Like, there is no way to cheat around it. Everyone's calibrated. You turn up to the event, they hand you this thing, which you plug into your XT60, and then you're even. There's no cheating. And something like that would level the field, and it would quickly get everyone to the same point. Because
I'd almost argue that, like, weight limits and maybe static thrust limits, you know, as stupid as they might be, at least you can actually just do that on site. Stick it on a scale and just go, just crank the throttle and see what it does, and mandate it that way. I don't, like Jonathan said, I don't think it's, I don't think it's a, going to be really appropriate to favour a manufacturer over another one, or say, you know, you can buy from these three manufacturers. That's not going to work.
Or you set a spec and tell the manufacturers to build it to the spec, and then you certify that this.
Yes, but it'd be out of date
in a heartbeat.
Yeah, and that's the problem, right? Is that I think for us, and this is one thing that Ash and Phil brought up in Te Papa, and I think what they're going to try and do next season is, and it's also something I'm probably going to do as well, is that they're going to build a machine for the season. So they're going to buy all the gear, they're going to run that gear for the season, and then at the end of the season they'll change to a new set of stuff. Because at the moment, even I'm replacing stuff, or I was replacing stuff pretty much every single month, because there was something better and faster coming out, and you had to have that to keep ahead. Because the New Zealand scene is now so competitive, there's no way you can't run the latest. Well, I mean, you can, but there's a lot of the time there's no way you can run older gear and still be ahead, or still be in that top tier. It's very hard to do that.
You need to bring your old stuff down next week and give it to me.
It's all sold. and a lot of the really old stuff is just not usable at all. You know, I've got a drawer full of 1806 2300 kV motors, which are a waste of time. I wouldn't even put those on a plane, let alone a quad. I'm just looking around now what I've got. There's nothing really I've got now which I'd actually go, oh, that's super old, other than maybe some of the motors, but
no, I don't want super old. Just last week's would be okay.
I've actually gotten into a habit of cleaning out stuff now, which is quite good. I actually got a box of stuff I'll bring down. I've got a box of stuff I'll bring down, and you can have a dig through, because I've got a bunch of frames in there and some PDBs and all sorts of bits and bobs. Nothing too major though. There's nothing powertrain wise. I've got a bunch of props you can have. That's about that. Bunch of tri-blades.
Tri-blades.
I can bring those down, no problem. Because that's another thing as well. Props. How many times have I changed props in the last year?
Is ridiculous. I've lost. I've got boxes. These are the greatest things ever, and no, they're no longer the greatest things ever. They're terrible.
No. Just Yongzi will come in and go, oh, the Cyclones are awesome, and then there'll be like a V2 out next week.
Because they weren't that awesome and they fell apart.
Yes, pretty much. That's why I let James test things now. You've got to let James test it first. So Model Fly New Zealand also has their own drone racing that they do. Is that like a serious thing, or is that not a serious thing? How's that work?
I mean, all of the stuff that Matt organises is done through Model Fly New Zealand. And nearly all of the courses are actually run on MFNZ sites of one description or other. My house is a registered flying site, so I can fly over all my neighbours' properties without asking them. Although they're pretty cool about it. They usually come and watch. They enjoy it. But no, I mean, we look after Matt, and we provide insurance for all of the guys that he sends racing. And I mean, I'm curious as to what people feel more we could be doing for them. Bearing in mind, of course, that we're an organisation of people who pay money to be part of the organisation. Yep. So they're the ones who get first dibs on fixing stuff. People who care not to join come second in the queue.
Yeah. And I think that's an important thing as well to note, is that when we do red across events, the Model Fly New Zealand, so the cost that you pay to go to an event, a portion of that, if you're not a member of Model Fly New Zealand, goes towards the insurance, and then the rest of it goes towards the event organizer for whatever whatever it costs to run the event. So at every single event, at least major event anyway, not the grassroots local stuff, but every major national event that Rotocross puts on is backed by Model Fly New Zealand for the insurance, and is typically on a Model Fly New Zealand field as well. So people need to bear that in mind. So when they ask what does Model Flying New Zealand give me as the pilot? For one, the insurance. So just quickly, you know, not too much detail, but just generally, what does that insurance actually give the pilot, and how much does it actually cost to join Model Flying New Zealand?
The insurance is essentially third-party damage. So if you lose control of your quad and hit somebody's car with it, and they claim against you, then that's what the insurance is for. Personal injury is covered by ACC. If your quad lands in the field and sets fire to the forest, then the fire cover is provided by our insurance policy. If your LiPo sets fire to itself and sets the forest on fire.
Does that cover you anywhere, flying anywhere, or does it have to be on a Model Flying New Zealand field?
It covers you anywhere in the country. It's a national policy.
Sweet. So how much is it to join Model Flying New Zealand? So you get the magazine, you get all the news, and you get the insurance. How much is that?
Annual membership is $75, and then depending on which club you join through, there is a variable amount. Clubs that pay a lot of money in rent and have expensive lawnmowers tend to be a bit more expensive, possibly in the region of $150 a year. Open Skies, I think, will be $80 this year because they have no real estate to look after.
Yeah, yeah. And Open Skies is started by Matt Wellington.
Open Skies is started by Matt Wellington, yeah. And last year had about 60 members. And they're generally guys who want the advantages of being members of Model Flying New Zealand but don't have a local club that they want to belong to.
Yeah, so if I'm flying in a park, I'm still covered.
Yes, you are.
Why wouldn't you do that?
The other thing people forget as well is Model Flying New Zealand is a democracy, and literally everyone apart from the secretary is a volunteer involved. The secretary gets a small amount of funds to it, so it's a full-time job. So if you want to change something in Model Flying New Zealand, sign up, become a member, and get involved. Like, we're all volunteers, and everyone is there to enjoy flying toy planes. So if you want something to change, just pipe up and get involved and do it.
I don't even, you know, that's a portion of it, but, you know, a lot of the time the comments I see is, why do I need to become a member? And I think you've just explained it, the fact that, you know, we fly these things at 80 miles an hour in a park, there's got to be some time when somebody's going to get one in the face or in a car, or, you know, you just get tapped when you're doing a bit of racing, and it goes out of control and does something bad. It's only that one time, and for the cost of, I think, $80 for open skies, that's kind of a no-brainer. And when you also factor in that when you go to an event, a rallycross event, you have to pay $15 for a temporary membership anyway, why wouldn't you just pay $80 and get covered no matter how much you fly?
But yeah, I guess it's
yeah, yeah. I guess it's the same as people that drive without insurance. I guess that same mentality. But still, to me, it's a no-brainer. You know, I fly a lot, so the more chances the more times I fly, the more chances are that something is going to happen. So I would prefer to be covered.
And it's makes good it easier cover when as well.
It is.
I forget the final figure. So is it $100 million liability cover? It's a huge amount.
The largest amount is forest fire, which is $10 million.
Oh, $10 million, sorry.
So whoever set the Port Hills on fire would be covered.
Maybe not.
Partly.
All those helicopters must have cost a bottle too.
Yeah. That would be an interesting council meeting.
Yeah. Pay in installments, lay by. You'd be sweet.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. Well, that's good. That's some excellent information. And the other thing as well that you guys do is that you mentioned that you obviously have the F3K team that you send across, and Model Flying New Zealand fund partly some of their trip to these events.
Yes. Generally, the funding that we provide covers all of the entry fees and goes towards uniforms for the teams and some of the other incidental expenses. But generally we're doing the soaring this year. We're sending the aerobatics team to Taiwan, I think it is. We sent a team of in the end, 28 people went to Australia last year because the control line world champions are in Australia. So there are many of the disciplines other than soaring get support from the funding, and we put money towards the guys going to the worlds in Hawaii with how many of you went, Jacko? Nine?
Yeah, it was nine of us. Yeah, nine of us that went there. So
yeah, so we supported that as well. So
yeah, no, that's excellent. So for those people that ask, what does Model Flying New Zealand do for me as a pilot, or you as a pilot? Now you know, they do everything. they enable you to fly for a start.
And the question is, what do you want us to do? You know, it's all very well saying, oh, we need to. What do you actually want people to do for you?
Buy my gear.
Yeah, buy
it. No. Well, yeah, got to ask. It's a democracy. Put it to the vote, eh?
Yeah, that's not going to
work. Nah.
Yeah, nah.
do Model Flying New Zealand have any, I mean, do you or Model Flying New Zealand specifically have any ideas for FP events going forward? Do you have any kind of thoughts or schemes that you might want to try out or do, or is it just a case of just sit back and just continue on as we are?
I think it's pretty much continue as we are. There's been an interesting conversation going on recently about the numbers of people taking part in racing and comparing this year with last year. And last year was all centrally managed, and so the data was all collected. This year there have been local chapters who've been running their own affair, and so there's been less information, which on first impressions is, well, there are far fewer people racing this year than last. But actually, I think it's just that local areas have been doing their own thing, and we've not been capturing the information in the same way. So we're keen to support it any way that the Matt and his team want to play it. I'd like to see the actual national championships run at our nationals. We put on 2 days of racing at the nationals this year, but it wasn't your final event of the year. And so if we can get those timescales sorted out, that would be more meaningful. And then we can present the Rotocross Champion Prize at the main prize giving, along with soaring and aerobatics and control line and everyone else.
My only beef with that is the time of year. And it's that January time. It was the same with helis when I was into helis. Having the Model Flying New Zealand in Nats in, what is it, January 4th or something?
Yep, about that.
I'm at the beach. There's just no chance.
You're at the beach.
Yeah, bro.
Priorities, mate. That's family, a serious, man. That's a serious first world problem.
That is. But yeah, it's always the time of year for me, and that's why I don't really get back into racing until the end of January, pretty much. Start getting back into racing until the end of January. So this, you know, that last week of December, right through to pretty much the end of January, I'm not doing anything with the hobby, which is, I guess, a lot of what other people do as well. Particularly, you know, drone pilots.
I think it's just you.
You reckon?
Yeah.
All right, okay. Maybe it's just me then.
It seems to me whenever you put the national, someone complains about the date.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. You're not going to please everyone.
There are 10 different disciplines, and you'll never get a perfect answer that suits everybody.
No, absolutely not. No. And that's cool. I mean, Matt held the... He did hold a rotocross event, didn't he, at the Nets?
Yeah. Oh, you didn't come along. It was epic, man.
Yeah. 2 days of epic racing.
Yeah, there we go. And who won it? Was it Steve?
Steve came second, because I've still got his trophy. Oh, no, I gave his trophy to you, didn't I?
No, he no, because Matt did his usual trick of getting the numbers wrong. Doing the old, oh, well done, congratulations, you've won. Oh, no, wait a minute, no, you haven't. But in this case, he did it in the reverse. So, oh, well done, you've got second, but actually Steve won on points.
Sweet.
But I believe he didn't take first off whoever got first, which I don't know who it was. But there you go.
But again, the great thing about it is it's now, that's the third year we've run rotocross racing at the national championships and shown other people what it's all about.
Mm.
Has there been much interest when you do that?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I went to an event at Hawke's Bay 2 weeks ago, and I put a couple of FPV cameras on thin bits of plywood with a battery and a transmitter, and we duct taped them to people's aeroplanes. And so we had a video feed back to the pits area and a TV screen up so people could see FPV working and pass the goggles around.
And how was that received? Because that's the thing I always do, is that whenever I see a plane, I'm like, where's your FPV camera? Why can't I fly that? Because to me, that makes absolute sense, that you've got this awesome plane, why are you not flying in it?
And people aren't aware of the technology, of the size of the equipment, and the quality of the picture, and it's all spreading the word and saying this is it's far more immersive if the camera's in the aeroplane.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, I mean, there's some stunning aeroplanes that I've seen flying around. I'd be like, that'd be awesome if I was just inside it.
Have you seen that? I think it's a Typhoon. It's a scale Typhoon model.
Yes.
The guy's got a full working cockpit. It's amazeballs.
He's got all the ductive fan things at the back as well, the vectored thrust and all that kind of jazz.
Yeah, and all the throttle levers move. It's just badass.
Yeah.
Full-on jet pilot.
And he's got head tracking as well, so you can look around when you're up there. Yep. So a lot of your planes will be able to fit head tracking in as well. And for those that don't know what head tracking is, basically you just move your head around so you can, it's as though you're in the vehicle looking at the side window or left window, you know, front, whatever you want. That to me is awesome in a plane.
Brilliant technology.
Mm. All right. Well, I think we've gone on long enough. It's been an hour 20 almost, which is a fairly long episode. Hopefully you've had fun on here, Jonathan.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm looking out the window as it's got darker, thinking, well, this time next week we'll be night racing in my garden.
Yep. So if you haven't booked in for that, make sure you do book in for that. That's going to be from the Friday people are getting there until Sunday,
Sunday,
I guess.
Yep.
Cool. All right. I know Steve and I and Yongzi and Timmy G will be down there Friday day at some point. I think we're going to do some stops on the way down and hopefully not wreck some gear. No promises there, though. But yeah, we'll be down there Friday, so that'd be cool. And thank you to you, Jacko, for your maximum legitness. Yeah,
nice
and
to
next
talk
time,
to you again.
Next time you can be a Batman.
Awesome.
Rather than the Joker, or Robin, or whoever they think you are. Awkward silence. And thanks to our episode sponsors, which are Quad Junkie and Race for Light. Make sure you check out the coupon code THEHYPETRAIN for Quad Junkie, which will give you 5% off all of your purchases. You wouldn't have heard that, Jonathan, because you don't listen to our podcast.
Yeah.
And also, if you want to purchase from raceforlight.net, they've given us 10% off any of your purchases using the coupon code THEHYPETRAIN. So thanks to those guys, and we'll catch you next time.
Where's my wing firmware for Race Flight?
Shut up. Goodbye.
Do it. Do it.
Bye.
Stop pissing around.
Goodbye, everyone. Till next
Bye.
Time.